So I think it's fair to say that we all believe that all of our behavior, perception, and thoughts are carried out by neural computations, by computations in neural circuits. But how this happens on the mechanistic level is not understood even in the simplest of behaviors. Consider, for example, very basic behavior that you perform many times a day that is easiest to illustrate if you imagine yourself riding on a train through beautiful scenery. You look out of the window, and you can't help it, but your eyes keep following these telegraph poles that pass by the side of the road. So if your eyes were doing this, you just performed an optokinetic response. This is a very basic kind of behavior consisting in following moving objects in front of you. And this kind of behavior is characteristic not just to humans, but to the majority of visual animals, including invertebrates, such as fruit flies. So in this experiment, this is the visual stimulus presented to the fruit fly. It's going to start moving in a minute. And this is the fruit fly, which would like to turn its eyes to follow this stimulus. But of course, flies cannot turn their eyes. They can only turn their whole body. But the fly is glued to the apparatus. And so what is instead happening is it's turning its feet, and the ball under its feet is rotating, as shown here by the black line, in the direction opposite to the movement, showing that the flies do perform this behavior, which in this case is called optomotor response. When the stimulus starts moving leftwards, the sphere starts rotating in the other direction. And you can also see that there is a perception of motion in the fly's brain by looking at the activity of one particular neuron in the visual system called HS, where the calcium concentration increases with time in response to the stimulus moving to the left. So maybe we should do this again. So when the stimulus will start moving to the right, this neuron does not respond. While the fly is trying to turn to the right. But when the stimulus starts moving to the left, the fly changes its direction in which it's trying to turn. And at the same time, this neuron becomes active, registering visual motion to the left. So not only can flies perform this behavior, but there is a mechanism, of course, to detect visual motion, as is shown by the activity of this neuron HS. But how this signal is computed from the visual input like this has been a long-standing problem in neuroscience. If you think about it for a minute, you realize that the direction of motion is not possible to tell by processing signals from only one photoreceptor pointing at a single location in the visual field. Because if you have a target that moves to the left, it produces this kind of an output. And if this target is symmetric and moves to the right, it produces the same kind of the signal profile with time. So neurons that are receiving the signals from this photoreceptor cannot tell the difference between the left movement and the right movement target. But it turns out that if you just allow two photoreceptors, which point in different adjacent but different locations in the visual field, then those signals are sufficient to detect motion. And this was realized first, perhaps, by Hassenstein and Riker, who about 60 years ago, performed a series of experiments like the one I showed you, except that they were a little bit low-tech and were done on a beetle. And as a result of those experiments, they proposed this very simple model of motion detection that combines inputs from two photoreceptors after delaying one of the signals and then multiplying the two branches. To get an intuition of how this model responds to motion, let's consider a target moving to the left. Then it excites the right photoreceptor before the left one. But because of the delay, the two signals arrive at the multiplication unit at the same time, get nonlinearly enhanced, and signal leftward motion. These are the profiles of signals in the left, right branch, and after multiplication. To see that there is zero output, let's consider the target moving to the right in the so-called null direction. Then the signal from the left photoreceptor passes and gets extinguished in the multiplication unit before the signal from the right photoreceptor arrives. And as a result of the multiplication, you get zero output. So this is a very simple model of a motion detector, which is based on detecting correlations between the visual signals displaced in space and time. If there are any questions, please don't hesitate.
My model would only respond for a certain velocity.
That's right. That's right. And you will see towards the end of the talk how we think that problem is solved by the real brain.
But it also is delay-oriented to left-right, right?
That's right. So it only responds to the left motion.
Yeah.
So there has to be a symmetric component that detects the right one. And Hassenstein-Reichert did have it. I just didn't want to complicate the diagram. But this is not the only model of motion detection. 10 years after Hassenstein and Reichert, Barlow and Levick performed experiments now on the vertebrate retina, where there are also motion sensitive cells. And they proposed, as a result of those experiments, a somewhat different model that also combines inputs from two photoreceptors pointing at adjacent but different locations in the visual field. But the time delay is on the other branch, and the two inputs are combined with different signs and pass-through rectification. To be completely honest, I should say that the original Barlow-Levick model actually used an AND-NOT operator here. But for analog signals, which is what happens in biology, I think this the AND-NOT operator can be recast as a nonlinearity following subtraction. To see how this model works, let's first consider the null direction. Then the left photoreceptor is excited before the right one. Because of the delay, the two signals arrive at the same time, but they're a different sign, and so they get canceled out, signaling no motion. But when the target moves to the left, then the right photoreceptor signal gets sent through the rectification unit before the left photoreceptor signal has a chance to cancel it out, and signals leftward motion. So these are the two basic candidates for the motion detectors in vertebrates and invertebrates, but not the only ones. There are many others, and I tried to make a list, although it's probably not complete. There are different variations of each of those suggestions, hybrids of the two, and there are a couple of unrelated suggestions. But despite all this theoretical work and all the experimentation, which there was a lot on the subject, over 60 years, we still don't know which of those models is actually correctly describing what happens in the insect brain. So why is there such a situation? Is there a question?
Yeah, so just to get a sense of it, I'm just wondering what happens when you change the dimension. So if you're going to 2D, and I say you had a ring or something, they all need to be delayed with respect to each other.
Yeah.
But then that's a problem, because how can they all be delayed with the frustration?
So I think it will become clear towards the end of the talk, but just jumping ahead, if you just basically clone this kind of simple circuits, but displace them spatially in different directions, then you will have signals that will respond preferentially to one of the axes of motion, and then presumably neurons downstream can process that. Okay? So why don't we know? Why is it such a simple computation? Why don't we know how is it implemented in the brain? And you might think that in this case, there's a lot of experimental data, like that behavioral experiment with the fly turning a ball under its feet, and you can figure out how it responds to stimuli of different spatial and temporal frequencies and distinguish between models. But it turns out that there is enough flexibility in choosing the parameters of the models to basically tune them to satisfy all the experimental constraints that exist from the behavioral point of view. So the black box approach by itself doesn't quite get you there.
For example, your second mechanism involves two populations, right? One excitatory, one inhibitory. Can't that be distinguished from the
not behaviorally.
But by inhibition specifically.
So this is a difficult question to answer because in insects, it was not simple to do this manipulation. In the retina where this manipulation was done, it actually led to conflicting results depending on how you do this. Maybe we can discuss the details afterwards. But all I'm saying at this point is that behaviorally you couldn't differentiate. In a nutshell, inhibition does a lot of things, not just this. So if you shut down it uniformly, then you screw up a lot of things. To shut down in a specific way, you need to know which neurons are involved in this. And that was not known. And that's the point I was going to make, right? So it kind of jumped ahead. Was there a question?
Yeah. I'm sorry to lag so much behind, but my question is, do we need these models in opposition to an array of parallel, multiple photoreceptors that will be able to sense both motion and speed?
Yes, the answer is yes.
I mean, the eye tried to make an array of multiple photoreceptors.
Yes.
So
this would be elementary detectors that would repeat periodically throughout the eye.
One single receptor in the array would also be able to calculate or compute direction and speed.
I mean, this is one element of the array. So the photoreceptors are aligned like this, and the question is what comes after photoreceptors. And what their suggestion of Hassenstein-Reichert was that this is the periodic circuit that repeats behind photoreceptors, okay?
In order to detect motions of different speed, should there be different sets of a series of different delays?
Yes. So you will see a part of the answer to this question. There will be some slop in the delay that will take care of. So what I was trying to say is that, okay, so behavior could not give an answer to this. Perhaps electrophysiology could, but the problem is that a recording, at least in fruit flies, is very, very difficult and takes 1 year of good postdoc's time to characterize one cell type. And there are 60 cell types in the relevant part of the fly brain. So you either need 60 good postdocs or 60 years of one good. How about recording from all neurons at once using optophysiology, right? Like this calcium imaging, and you know, you could record from all the neurons like our president wants us to, and can you figure it out then? Well, the problem is that it would still be very, very difficult, if not impossible, because you don't know the circuit. So for example, if you detected a delay in one of the neurons, you wouldn't know whether this is an evidence for this or that circuit, because you wouldn't know whether that neuron was in the right branch or in the left branch. So what we decided to do is to address this problem anatomically, to reconstruct the actual circuit down to individual synapses that underlies this computation and see whether that can tell us which model correctly describes what's happening in the real brain. So the story that I'm going to tell you today will have three parts. First, I'll tell you about the technology development that we had to do to make such circuit reconstruction possible. Then I will tell you how we use that technology to reconstruct that part of the fly brain that does motion computation and assembled this very detailed wiring diagram, so-called connectome, of that part of the nervous system. And then how we managed to find in that connectome, which had hundreds of neurons, we were able to find the specific neurons responsible for motion detection and the particular synaptic connection between those neurons that formed a circuit motif responsible for motion detection. But that motif was small enough so that we could actually analyze it and get evidence to decide which model is right. And the final part of that story will be electrophysiological experiments that were enabled by our anatomical data, where the recordings were made from the neurons involved, and we could interpret these recordings based again on our circuitry to decide which of the two models is implemented in the fly. So how do you reconstruct a connectome? Well, you probably all know that neuronal processes are very thin and packed very tightly in the brain. And so to image all the connections, light microscopy doesn't quite cut it. You need to do electron microscopy at high resolution. And the way you do electron microscopy has been known for more than 40 years. You take a chunk of the brain, you fix it, and embed it, meaning you turn it into a piece of plastic. You slice that piece of plastic into thin slices, like prosciutto, except that each slice is 40 nanometers thick. You image every slice. So that's the prosciutto part. And then you image each slice under electron microscope. And the contrast comes from heavy metal ions that stick to the lipid membranes and outline the cross sections of individual neurons. Those are the grayscale images that you get. And then, if you align those images in the computer on top of, we first segment those cross sections as shown here by the false color. And then, if you align those images on top of each other, or in an orderly way as they were related to each other before the block was cut, and connect the corresponding cross sections, you get 3D shapes, you get synapses, and if you can trace those synapses to cell bodies, then you can know which neurons are connected, draw arrows between them, and assemble the connect.
You don't know if the synapse is active or inactive, it's inhibitory or excitatory. Is that the reason?
So typically, we assume that if the synapse exists, it does communicate electrical signals from one neuron to another, because otherwise, why would it be there?
Well, that's not all. It can exist presently. I mean, synapses are, people have shown that by dynamic visualization that synapses can create, it can disappear. It's a dynamic object. So sometimes they can be stabilized for a longer term time. But there are nice images by the group of Denk on very dynamic synapses. So
it is indeed true that synapses can come and go. But in this particular system, the connectivity turns out to be highly stereotypical from individual to individual. And now, when we reconstructed more than a single circuit of that kind, we know that there is a very high reproducibility in the number of synapses. So even if an individual synapse comes and goes, the total number of synaptic connections between a pair of neurons is generally conserved. Of course, I can only say this with confidence for strong connections. There could always be a connection between a pair of neurons where a single synapse comes and goes. But these are not the connections we will focus on. We will focus on the strong ones that have tens to hundreds of connections. So for them, there is no problem.
And how do you know this, their sign?
That question is more serious. Indeed, the unfortunate aspect of fly anatomy is that we cannot tell the sign of a synapse from electron microscopy. We are expecting to get the data from another approach called RNA sequencing, which tells us which neurotransmitters and receptors are expressed in individual cell types, but we don't quite have that data yet. So indeed, that's an unknown.
But you're tracking the neurons themselves, so you have morphological information about the neurons from which you can tell it's an amacrine cell, it's a, if you're in cortex, you can tell it's a pyramidal cell, it's a basket cell, so you can tell.
So that's
cases whether it's an excitator.
Right, so that is correct indeed. In the cortex, it's much easier to tell. You can tell from the cell type whether it's excited or inhibitory because they obey Dale's rule. And you can tell from an individual synapse whether it's excited or inhibitory by seeing whether its ultrastructure is symmetric or asymmetric. Unfortunately, neither of those facts hold in the fly brain. Okay, so given those, yes?
So the fly neuron, so a single neuron can be both excitatory and inhibitory?
It's not forbidden.
So it's possible, you say?
It is possible.
You found neurons that have both?
I did not find, because I did not look, but I can name neurons in other invertebrates like C. elegans that have both excitatory and inhibitory effect. For example, glutamate expressing neurons can have both excitatory and inhibitory effect. And actually, in invertebrates, they're often inhibitory because glutamate acts on a chloride chain.
So the same transmitter, just different effects.
Right. Okay, so there is levels of complexity here. You could have same transmitter having both excitatory and inhibitory effect. Strictly speaking, Dale's rule refers to the fast neurotransmitters. It says there's only one neurotransmitter. Now, even that, I'm not sure is true in fly, but I don't have the data one way or another. Okay? All right. So
the same cell is going to have both excitatory and inhibitory effect. Is that possible?
It is
possible.
That's
a different statement from a neurotransmitter.
Exactly. That's why I'm saying different levels of complexity. Yes. So I think that the canonical Dale's rule says that each neuron expresses only one fast neurotransmitter. But
that's going to be the same. I mean, that holds true also for the fly brain. The one cell.
It's not completely clear. I don't know. I mean, we will see from RNA sequencing data very soon whether this is the case or not.
There is another question. How do you compare brains from different flies? How do you correlate neuron 1, 2, 3 from different flies?
I will show to you in a minute an image that will hopefully convince you that the stereotypy of the visual system in fly is so high that just by seeing the shape of a neuron, you can tell which cell type it is.
What brain region is this, and what's the mammal analog?
What is what?
The mammal, you know, analog region.
So the brain region we'll reconstruct, I will introduce in a minute. Just to jump in ahead, it's amygdala. Mm-hmm. The analog, that gets tricky, but it's probably the inner plexiform layer of the vertebral retina. All right, so this beautiful animation might have made an impression that connectomics is a very easy and pleasant exercise, and you know the arrows just grow by themselves, and synapses trace themselves to neurons, but nothing can be further from the truth. It's actually very difficult. And it is true that you know this prosciutto slicing requires virtuoso proficiency, but in terms of the bottleneck, the time bottleneck is due to the step that happens after the images are taken. Because of the very high resolution of electron microscopy, even a volume of this size that was used to produce an animation has many thousands of photographs. And tracing from a synapse to a neuron takes a very long time. In this case, the reconstruction for this animation would take a person a few months to a year. And the volume we will need to answer the motion detection question is 100 times bigger, making this prohibitively expensive. Here is why that is the case. This is an example of the real data from the fly brain. I'm showing you a 9x9 montage of a single slice out of almost 3,000 through the fly brain. And of course, at this resolution, you cannot see much ultrastructure. But if you zoom into the square, zoom in again and again, then you get to the level of detail that is necessary to identify synaptic connections. So just to orient you, each closed contour here is a cross-section through a neurite, that is through a dendrite on an axon. And you can identify the synapses by finding this very small close circles that are called neurotransmitter vesicles, and a presynaptic specialization that is special to flies, or rather to invertebrates, that is called a T-bar. So that you know that there is a presynaptic terminal, meaning that information is communicated from this neuron to these guys. So in fly brain, there could be multiple postsynaptic terminals, which we can identify both by proximity and by this postsynaptic densities. So we know that there is a synaptic transmission happening at this location. But of course, from this image alone, we don't know which neurons are talking here. To determine that, you would have to trace, as shown in the animation, from the synapse to the cell body, or at least far enough to identify neurons by their shape. And that cannot be done in the small image, which is only 1/1000th of the original montage that I showed you. And also, because of the three-dimensional shape of neurons, has to be done in a stack of images. And here is what a stack of images looks like. In addition to the size of the data set, it also had a lot of defects, making it more difficult to do the tracing. Job at Genelia when I got there was to automate this process to save the time that is needed for reconstruction. And we were able to overcome all of these difficulties and build the first semi-automated pipeline for high-throughput EM reconstruction or connectomics. This pipeline takes images, in this case from a traditional electron microscope, goes through the steps shown in the animation, including alignment, 2D segmentation, and linkage in 3D to assemble the shapes of neurons. Unfortunately, though, because of the limitations of the data set and the imperfections of the computer algorithms, there were a lot of errors in the assembled neuronal shape. So we still had to employ manual labor. And we had a group of highly dedicated, trained professionals that went through this data set and corrected those errors. That still remains the time bottleneck in the process. But our automation was able to reduce the amount of labor by almost an order of magnitude. So once we had the shapes of neurons and we annotated all the synapses, we were able to put that all together in a wiring diagram or a connectome shown here as a graph that you can barely see, but I will show it again with larger modification of those slides. I should also say that in addition to assembling this graph, we were able to identify neurons, as I mentioned before, just by their shape, where we compared the reconstructed shapes of neurons from electron microscopy with the shapes of neurons imaged by light microscopy using either traditional Golgi staining in a fly that lived more than 20 years ago, or more recent genetically modified flies that were built at Geneva. You can already see that there is enough stereotypy between neurons coming from different fly brains to decide that they likely belong to the same cell type called MI1 in this case, which allows us to label the graph. Please.
David's question, wasn't it that how do you tell between different neurons of the same cell type?
Different angles.
Sorry.
You mean different species?
No, individuals.
Well, so this came from different individuals.
But that's a single neuron, no?
I'm showing you a single neuron.
So how do you build the connectivity? You need to build the stereotype connectivity, you need to know that's neuron one, which is the same neuron. Am I getting it wrong?
Well, this is a neuron that is called MI1.
Okay. I think they're asking if you can define the correspondence between the neurons in one fly brain and another fly brain. Because at some point you said
there's
a great deal of similarity. Because these guys are asking you if you can reconstruct some graph for one fly, is the graph in another fly in any way similar?
Right. Beyond this, so different neurons of the same cell type repeat periodically in the fly visual system. So typically, there is one or less neurons of any given cell type in a unit cell of the visual system.
But then you're telling me you already know the computer graph.
I know it's periodic, but I don't know what it is.
The connectome between different animals, different individuals, how similar it is? Is it 99%?
So that the answer to that depends very much on which species and which part of the brain you're interested in. It so happens that in the fly visual system, the stereotypy is amazing. That, for example, we published already the analysis of the lamina part of the visual system, which comes before this, and there the numbers of synapses are conserved to better than 10%, if you just count how many synapses you have between a given pair of neurons.
But that's what they're asking, but to identify a given pair, there's this notion that you can take two neurons from one fly and put them into correspondence.
You do, yes, exactly.
And so can you just tell us, or maybe you will,
I will just wait 2 minutes and it will be, yeah, I see what you're saying. In 2 minutes it will become all clear, okay? All right? It's the next slide, literally. Okay? So this is the technology that we developed, and then we apply that technology to the fly visual system. Since our question was the motion detection circuitry, we had to figure out which part of the visual system is involved in it. So let me tell you what you need to know about the fly visual system to understand the rest of the talk. And that will answer this question. So as you know, flies have compound eyes that consist of about 800 microlenses. Behind each microlens, there are 8 photoreceptors. Together, that unit is referred to as an ommatidium. And the ommatidia are packed in a beautiful crystalline honeycomb lattice, collectively forming what's called a retina in fly. the output of the photoreceptors is sent to the next processing layer, the lamina, the medulla, the lobule, and the lobular plate. Each of those processing layers is organized retinotopically, meaning that it processes visual information in periodic circuits that are arranged in a way that corresponds to the organization of the retina. So now to answer your question, what happens is, at least early on in the visual system, is that information flow is processed in each of these modules that, at least in the medulla, are called columns. Each column contains a certain number of different neurons. Usually, each of those neurons belong to a different cell type. So there is only one neuron of a particular shape in that column. And then those neurons, those circuits, are reproduced 800 times in each other column.
So in each column, you only process the information from one omatidia?
Initially. So the first step, yes, but then they start mixing. But the circuitry remains largely periodic. Okay? So to identify the specific neuron between different fly brains, you need two things. You need to know its shape, which identifies cell type, and you need to know the column that it lives in, which can be addressed by, you know, longitude, latitude kind of coordinate system.
So was there any sign of this periodicity in the EM slices that you showed?
Yes, but you have to look very hard and squint a little to see that. And that's a general case. So actually, periodicity is easier to establish with light microscopy. EM just gives you too much information, and it's very hard to see. But if you try, you might be able to notice this kind of elliptical traces. So these are the columns. Well, okay. These are other kinds of periodic objects. You do not see the exact six-fold symmetric honeycomb lattice, because even though this is organized retinotopically, the neuropil is squished a little bit in one direction. So the lattice is a little bit distorted. Nevertheless, each column has six neighbors. Okay? All right. So the whole visual information is processed in this flow, but the question is, well, where is motion first detected? Where should we look for those motion detectors? And that's where we're very fortunate to have a lot of experimental data from 60 years of work in this field. For example, we knew that cell types called L1 and L2, which repeat in every column of the lamina, are necessary for motion detection. Because if you genetically silence them, flies become blind to motion. However, if you record from those neurons, they are not directionally selective, suggesting that they only provide input to the motion detection circuit. At the same time, we knew from previous work that these large neurons in the lobular plate, one of which is HS, the video of calcium activity in which I showed on one of the first slides, they are already responding to motion. But it has been established from previous work that these neurons actually don't compute the motions themselves. They integrate local motion signals from elementary detectors. And they just combine those inputs over the visual field. And that information is thought to be provided by the cells called T4 that sit in the medulla.
In this structure, which one is responsible for the delay? Like in the first model that you present, which one causes the delay or responsible for
I will be able to answer this question once I introduce the cell type that is not here yet. So we actually guessed that T4 were the outputs of the motion detection circuitry because they come in four subtypes that project to the four different layers of the lobular plate, each responsible for one of the cardinal directions of motion, up, down, front, and back, because flies have eyes on the side. But that guess was confirmed unambiguously by calcium imaging in those neurons that was published actually in the same issue of Nature as our paper by the Bors group. So we know for a fact that then T4s are the outputs of the motion detection circuitry. L1 are the inputs. But what lies in between was the big puzzle. And that's where all those 60 cell types that you couldn't record from live. And previous attempts to reconstruct the anatomy of medulla all failed because it's actually the biggest neuropil of the fly brain. And light microscopy really doesn't cut it there. So that's the part we attacked with our connectomics pipeline. I should also say that we simplified our task a little bit. We did not reconstruct the whole medulla because we knew from the periodicity of the circuitry that we only needed a small number of columns. And that guess was based on the experimental finding that to elicit motion response, both behavioral and physiological in flies, does not require a full field stimulus like those stripes that I showed you in the beginning. You can elicit the motion response by stimulating just two adjacent columns by shining the light sequentially, no matter where those adjacent columns are in the visual field. This is so-called phi effect, where you see motion when something is flashed at adjacent locations. And that's what Hollywood is based on. So flies have that behavior as well. And from that, we knew that the motion detection circuitry would just be identifiable by reconstructing the circuit of seven columns in the medulla, the central reference one, and six of its neighbors for each of the directions of motion. And that's what we did. We applied our connectomics pipeline to this part of the fly brain, and, oops, what are you moving? Oh, here it is, yeah. So this is the original data set, and out of it come the lamina terminals, and then the neurons postsynaptic to those inputs, and the neurons that are postsynaptic to them. And then the neurons that don't belong to the central column, but to the six adjacent columns. And seven of those columns together, they almost fully fill up this reconstructed volume of 40 by 40 by 50 microns. So altogether, our reconstruction includes almost 400 neurons and more than 8,000 synapses between them, which, by the count of synapses, makes it the biggest connectome to date, not just in flies, but in any nervous system.
So just to come back, for a neophyte like myself, that looks complete mess. I mean, if you compare this connectome to a server, a Cisco server, at least there you can recognize when cables come together and where they go, etc. So the question is, this mess, if you compare one fly to another, is it the same mess in both flies?
That's a good question, yeah. So the morphology of individual neurons on some rough level is sufficiently stereotypical. The synaptic connectivity graph is stereotypical too. The question is the individual arrangements of individual little dendrites and axons stereotypical or not, right? We don't know. At the moment, it's not completely clear. There are examples where they are, and there are examples where they're not. And so it seems like glass half full, half empty. So we're working now on trying to quantify these kinds of
looks like you have about 20 synapses per neuron there, or is that synapses per neuron?
No, that's the total, yeah.
Is that that seems like a low synapse count, or is that just...
Well, I mean, it depends what you compare it to.
Does that represent the total synapse count, you think, on those neurons?
Between those neurons. So these neurons have other synapses that are not counted in this count because they connect to neurons other than this 379.
Well, it does seem low, say, compared to humans.
So of course.
Does that fit with other neurons in the rest of the fly brain, say?
I'm not aware of the data of that kind, but it seems pretty rich compared to C. elegans. So, you know, that's okay. All right. So we filled in this black box with our connectome, which has all these neurons that now connect the inputs and the outputs. But just having that connectome doesn't really answer the original question, does it, right? So, okay, you have this big graph, so what?
Sorry, maybe you said it, but I missed it. So you fill the box, what fraction of it is full now? How many are missing? Do you have some estimate?
Yes, we do. In fact, it's a good question because actually in this particular reconstruction, primarily because of the limited Z resolution of the data set, we were able to trace only 50% of synapses that we annotated. Out of those 50% that we traced, we are fairly confident that they were traced correctly because we assigned each synapse to two independent proofreaders and only accepted the answer was the same in both cases, which happened in actually 96 to 97% of the cases.
But the cell bodies, presumably, you can locate rather ambiguously.
So the problem was connecting the very, very last nanometer, right, to the synapse. That was the hardest part because those processes are very, very thin, and they would often get lost, especially if they ran in the direction parallel.
I understand why assigning synapses will be the most difficult thing, but I can be confident that you have every neuron. It's just that some neurons, perhaps you have 60% of the synapses, and some neurons you have 20% of the synapses. But I guess I'm asking. So are there some neurons that for some reason are much more difficult to deal with than some other neurons?
It is indeed the fact that all neurons are equal, but some are more equal than others. And the fact is that we are most confident about so-called columnar neurons that mostly run through the column. We are less confident about the neurons that are called tangential that run perpendicular to the axis of the columns because we only have a fragment of those and it's hard to identify them from those fragments often. But for the columnar ones, the confidence arises because we have multiple examples of those in those columns. So we can actually now rely on the stereotypy to make sure we're right. And in fact, since this work was done, we have now re-imaged the same part of the fly brain with a newer microscope that has isotropic resolution in X, Y, and Z. And there we can trace 96% of synapses to their mother cells. And we are doing that now, and that's where we can actually do a very, very detailed comparison and answer the questions of stereotypy in a very precise and quantitative manner.
And you know that you have 50% right and 50%,
So the proofreaders were instructed to trace only if they're completely confident. And they were told that if they have doubts, they should just drop tracing that synapse. That's why they have only a 50% completion rate. But by comparing independent proofreaders tracing the same synapse, we know that they traced accurately because it would be unlikely that they made the same mistake. All right, so what are we going to do with this connectome? You know, spend so much money and so much time. And can we answer the question about motion detection? Well, the first thing we did, we compressed or condensed the connectome information. Because we knew that the motion detection circuitry can be obtained by looking at the circuits that repeat in every column, we initially focused on the cell types that happen once or more than once per column, that they are truly periodic, like L1 and L2. And then we assembled the connectivity between those cell types, where we ignored the identity of the neurons in terms of which column they belong to, but kept their identity in terms of the cell type. So each node of this graph you should think of as a connectivity, as a cell type, and the connection is a connectivity of cell types rather than individual neurons. The thickness of the edges represents the strength of connections as measured by the number of synapses in parallel. And that's why I was telling you that many connections have large number of synapses, so even if one synapse comes and goes, not much changes. Now, the way this graph was plotted, we used the graph layout algorithm, which puts stronger connected neurons, like this pair, closer to each other than the weaker connected ones. And just by using that algorithm alone, the whole connectome segregated into three clusters.
Okay, when you say that a given cell type to another cell type is 100 synapses or more, because it's a thick, you mean that's the total number of synapses. It's not every cell of this type to every
Okay,
cell
I'll be more precise. What this number means is the number of synapses made by one cell of a given cell type to all the other cells of another cell type.
But if I don't know how many other cells of that type are, how informative is to present the data that way?
Well, we had to present it some way. So
yes, typical people represent this data as probability of connection, saying, what is the probability that a cell of type A has a connection with a cell of type B? Or you could say, what is the probability?
Here it's all deterministic. Here it's all deterministic.
Okay.
And actually, so you know what, forget this detail. Actually, for most cells, all the connections are within one column. So most of the numbers correspond to the connection from L1 in a particular column to MI1 in that same column. There are a few exceptions that you will see, but they're more, they just confuse the issue.
But still, I don't know how many synapses the cell of type T4 receives from a cell in M1, because I don't know how many cells of type T4 are there.
Sorry, I'm asking for one extra number.
Yeah.
Yes,
what,
one extra number. Say, what is the number
M1
of synapses for one
L2
cell of type L1?
Okay, so
M1
for the majority of the cells, it's one cell of a given cell type per column, and almost all the synapses are to another cell within the same column. So for most of the cases, you just read off the number here, and it tells you the answer to your question.
Okay.
There are exceptions.
One cell per column?
Huh?
Are you saying that there's just one L1 per column?
There is for 25 out of 27 cell types, it's one per column. The exceptions are TM3 and T4. For the rest,
okay,
it's just one to one.
Thank you.
So one cell can make 100 synapses on another cell.
That's right. That's exactly what's happening. That's why I'm not too concerned about our 50% synapse completion rate, because it's a strong connection. We got only 100 synapses out of 200, still know it's there. Of course, it doesn't apply to connections that are only a single synapse strong, but these are the ones that we will ignore.
Of functionality, could you remind me? So I understood that T4 is the output.
Yep.
You said that T4 is sensitive to motion. L1 is one of those maybe delay lines or whatever. You said L1 and L2. I don't see where L2 sits there.
So L2 is here. L1 is here. And these are the two inputs. And T4 and T5 are the outputs.
T5 is also an output.
Yep.
And where is the receptor, the light sensitive, the cone, or
So the receptors provide inputs to L2, L1, L3, and these are the lightning bolts. And also two of the receptors, the color ones, are actually still in there, and that's R7 and R8. Okay? So these are the inputs. The lightning bolts indicate the inputs to the whole circuitry. The inputs to the motion detection circuitry are shown by this big arrow.
So if I understand correctly, these L1s and M1s are assigned sort of on the basis of cell geometry, morphology.
Yes.
But of course, you could assign them given names on the basis of connectivity.
Yes.
But the point is, you don't really need to know connectivity in order to assign, because just one look at the whether it's top of the layer, bottom of the layer,
right,
is all.
Right. Well, when we started this work, we didn't know what we can rely on. Now that we know, of course, we can just do spectral analysis of this graph, and everything will fall out.
Except it's probably easier to just see where the cell body is in, relative to the lamina or something. Right?
Yeah. So that's used for the shape. And actually, I have to be completely honest. The cell body itself in insects and invertebrates in general is not stereotypically located, and it sits outside of the neuropil and does not by itself participate in electrical conduction. And so, strictly speaking, the neuropil is just free of cell bodies. But the locations of the main axons and dendrites is stereotypical in the sense that you meant.
Are there any lateral connections between modules at this stage?
So that number starts with zero, the photoreceptors, and slowly increases as you go downwards towards the bottom of the medulla.
So that 8,000 odd, was that just connections within one module?
The majority of those connections were within one module, but we traced the connections between models as well, modules as well, and I don't remember the exact fraction. Okay, so as I mentioned, the graph layout algorithm allowed us to segment this into the three clusters, and they indeed correspond to this signal processing pathways, the L1 and L2, L3, R7, and R8. And it has been known from previous work, just like the one I cited, that motion detection is primarily implemented by L1 and L2 pathways, at least in flying flies. So that was our focus. But there was a little problem that T5 neurons actually sit outside of our reconstruction region of interest in the lobule and not in the medulla. And so we didn't really have those connections established at that time. And so we could not really complete this L2 pathway. But fortunately, L1 and L2 pathways are known to detect motion mostly independently. In fact, thanks to the nice work by Borsa and Clandini's labs, we know that those pathways correspond to the on and an off pathways in the vertebrate visual system. L1 is like an on pathway, and L2 is like an off pathway. And they detect motion independently, and it's a different kind of motion, so we just focused on the L1 pathway.
If I ask you, can you use the weights on this as a prediction? So is there electrophysiology that you can do that you can say, okay, I now expect...
In principle, there is, but it hasn't been done.
It's still not possible.
It's possible, but it's difficult. It's this, 60 good postdocs issue.
But you also don't know how strong each is.
So there is evidence from the vertebrate visual system that the actual physical size of a synapse correlates with its weight. And there is a lot of very nice work, actually some from Jack Stevens's lab, that shows that there is a very strong correlation between the dimensions of the synapse and various ultrastructural characteristics, like the numbers of dot vesicles, the size of the active zone, the size of the postsynaptic density, and so on. And they all correlate with the actual physiological weight. Now, it so happens that in flies, the size of the synapses are actually don't vary that much. No more than a factor of two or three or so. And so that's why we think that each synaptic contact has the same weight, and therefore we can approximate the total weight by counting the number of synaptic contacts. All right, so we've got the connectome pruned to this subconnectome, and we want to find out which neurons are responsible for motion detection. L1 is the input, T4 is the output, but what are the neurons involved in computed motion? And at that point, we just made an assumption. We said, well, motion detection is a fast and robust noise computation, so it is probably implemented by very direct and strongest possible connections. And because there are no direct connections from L1 to T4, we looked at disynaptic paths, of which there were two, through MI1 and TMP. And based on this, we formed a hypothesis that maybe these are the two arms of a correlation-based motion detector. I have to say that because of the way we computed the weights of those edges, it looks like this is very weak and this is very strong. It's not really true. It turns out that the weights of the inputs via MI1 and TM3 are comparable. MI1 is maybe 30% stronger than TM3. But what is important is that the total number of synapses from MI1 and TM3 accounts for 80% of synapses into T4. So it is indeed true that these two paths provide the majority of innervation to T4, justifying our hypothesis. So
a given T4 cell, what is the relative number of inputs that it receives from M1 and...
I think that the number from MI1 is 30% bigger than from TM3.
There is not really multiple photoreceptors for your circuit, so...
Yes, exactly. So exactly. Exactly. So that's exactly the point. So this circuit, I tried to condense it in terms of cell types so that not to make it messy. And so this represents all L1s in principle, okay? But to make a motion detection circuitry, one must combine inputs from different photoreceptors that point maybe at adjacent but spatially different locations in the visual field. Otherwise, you're back to a single photoreceptor case, then you cannot detect motion. So the question is, to support our hypothesis that these branches are implemented by MI1 and TM3, we need to figure out whether the actual photoreceptors that they conduct signals from correspond to different locations in the visual field. Because of the retinal copy, that corresponds to the different columns in the medulla. So the question is, do those TM3s that converge into a single T4 as these MI1s come from different photoreceptors? Okay? And so when we actually did that tracing in our connectome, we found schematically this is what we found. So unlike in the very simplified and basic circuit of the Barrow-Levick motion detector, we found that multiple TM3s converge onto a single T4. And then multiple L1 innervate a single TM3. This was also true, but to a lesser extent, for MI1s, and so I keep it as a one-to-one path. But you can see that it's already got more complicated than that original wire diagram.
Those are cross-modular.
That's right. So there is an overlap between the regions of visual field that provide inputs to T4 via TM3 and MI1. But just
in your previous slide, M1 was the one with the strongest weight.
Yeah, but that's...
You're suggesting that that's the one that will carry time delay.
That will carry the time delay. In Barlow-Levick, yes.
Can I see the fifth one? Once again, thank you. So, the strongest
Well, well, first of all, this representation of strength is not what you want to look for, because the convention here is the number of synapses from one presynaptic cells to a postsynaptic. Sure. But there is a different number of T4s and TM3s, and because of that, it's not the same as counting the number of synapses onto one postsynaptic cell.
It's exactly why this way of plotting is confusing. And it's well, presenting is not making the point.
Okay, maybe after the talk you can you can suggest a better way.
Well, a one-to-one. Just tell me how.
But I cannot possibly plot 300 neurons here.
No, a one-to-one, one cell of each a given group onto one cell of the other group. Not
but
all cells,
but you will see at the moment. Well, you see at the moment that there is different counts.
I didn't want to interrupt.
Okay. So there is an overlap between the two kinds of inputs. Okay, that potentially destroys this hypothesis, right? But is that overlap complete? Are the two parts of the visual field that provide inputs to your TM3 or MI1 the same, or are they slightly different? Because there is an overlap, but the two regions are displaced, you can still implement a motion detector. So to answer this question.
So wasn't this apparent even in that wonderful cartoon at the beginning with the different crystal, different sort of structures going in? You said, right, that they were, but I mean, even at that level, like this tree diagram that you've drawn here, that was relatively apparent in that. When you have those three different layers, and right?
Perhaps. I'm not aware of a published result like that, but maybe you could see it in the reconstruction.
No, I'm asking.
In some sense you could. I'm surprised you saw it there, but if you really did have that reconstruction on your computer, you would be able to figure that out. Okay? As I will.
The cartoon, not the reconstruction.
The cartoon.
Yeah.
Oh.
Cartoon of the photoreceptors in that layer and then the...
This one. Oh, that one. Yeah, but because I did the cartoon when I already knew the answer. All right. So are the two regions of the visual field that provide inputs to TM3s and MI1s converging on the same T4 the same or not? To answer that question, I'm going to show you the real reconstruction, okay, and you will see it for yourself. So to understand what I'm showing you, imagine that you shrunk yourself and you're sitting on a T4 looking towards the world, the fly retina, and I'm not going to show MI1 and TM3. So this is what you're going to see from the vantage point of T4, right? These are the axonal terminals of L1s that are arranged in this lattice, which is a squished honeycomb lattice. Each cone has six neighbors, and they carry signals from the photoreceptors pointed in the corresponding directions in the visual field, because this whole system is retinotopic. Now, on top of those axonal terminals, I overlay the dendrites of MI1s and TM3s innervating a single T4. As shown in the schematics, each of those cell types, in fact, forms a cloud spanning multiple columns, maybe more columns for TM3s than for MI1s. But what's most important is if you plot the centroids, they are indeed displaced. So even though the blue and the red components of the receptive fields detected anatomically are overlapping, the centroids are displaced.
You're telling us about the centroids because the pictures are the most striking effect is that one is much broader than the other, and
right.
Both are anisotropic, no?
Well, anisotropy mostly comes from the squishing of the neuropil. Not all, but mostly. Okay? But yes, I mean, that was something that I did not expect, but actually then, we looked up some old literature, and there was work using physiology and systems identification analysis that actually suggested that those two receptive fields are broad and overlapping. And there are some arguments why it's a good idea. But to have a motion detector, you need to have the centroids displaced. You just can't do without.
Can you tell whether the connectivity extends even further, or are you limited by the size of the...
So we're pretty sure we're getting, for these cells, we're getting all the connectomes because they kind of, the number, the counts, so let me show the counts of synapses, right? So the counts of synapses actually trail to zero before we get to the point where we can't reconstruct. For these neurons. Okay. But not, I mean, there are other neurons that are, of course, close to the boundary of our reconstruction, but those we exclude.
I don't understand this argument about the centroid. I thought that you can detect motion if one neuron would, and this is what you're saying there, that one neuron would be sensitive to what happens in one receptor cell, and another one would be sensitive to...
That's the simplified view.
Right. The nearby cell, well, maybe not, maybe one, maybe the nearby...
Right.
Receptor cells, which your TMT seems to be sensitive, and your picture there, and they're pointed actually as a support of your cartoon in the needle.
Exactly. Okay. That's
so
what we're.
So, what does the centroid?
Well, because.
If the centroid would fall at the same point, it would still work.
No, because then there is a symmetry, and the response to the target moving left or right will be exactly the same.
There's four T4s, right? One for each direction?
Yes.
It's not obvious because the asymmetry can reside in something else, in delays, and God knows what, right? But just looking at the picture, you know, the question in my mind is it even statistically significant to talk about the centroid of that thing?
That's a very good question. Let me answer. So, first of all, the shift of centroids that I'm showing you was actually computed not from the geometry of dendrites. But the counts of actual synapses made in each of the columns, the percentages of which are shown here in blue for MI1 and in red for TMT. Okay, so these are actual synapses from the connectome. Okay? So it is functional receptive fields. Now, you're absolutely correct. Question is it even significant? And even if it is significant, what does it tell us? Right? Just because there is a displacement between the centroids doesn't mean this is a motion detection circuitry. For example, think of an on-center, off-surround ganglion cell in a vertebrate retina. It may not be directional selective, but there would still be a little displacement between the on and an off receptive field. So how do we know? Ideally, to answer this question, what the evidence I would like to show you is to say that, well, the directional preference of this T4 mapped out physiologically, either with electrical or optical recordings, agrees with the anatomical displacement. Then you would be convinced, right? Well, unfortunately, I cannot give you that because this fly has been dead for 5 years. But, it turns out that I can still tell you what the directional selectivity of this T4 is because if I trace its axon down to the next processing station, the lobular plate, I can determine the directional selectivity of this T4 by figuring out in which sublayer of the lobular plate its axon terminates. Because it has been known from previous work that each of the four sublayers of the lobular plate is responsible for the motion in one of the four cardinal directions shown here by the colored arrows. And so this particular neuron terminates in the green sublayer, which corresponds to forward motion, which if you project using retinotopy, this displacement to the visual field is that direction. Of course, this is just one cell, but I have to tell you that, you know, this is very, very difficult. I mean, it looks like a squiggly line, but this is tracing through 1,000 layers of electron micrographs of the kind that I showed you before. And it takes a lot of effort. And actually, when I first asked the guys to do that, we thought it was impossible. But they were able to do this and to trace it, not just for one T4 cell, but for many T4 cells.
But there's also a strong statement that if it's one of the cardinal dimensions, so is it really going to be discrete? So therefore the prediction is that if you do a lot of it, you're going to see the sort of fourfold of the
That's right. That's right. That's right.
Mutual distribution.
That's right. So it's hard to tell at this point whether we see it or not. So what we did, we analyzed the data slightly differently. What we did, we took the displacements computed from the counts of synapses in different columns and averaged them over all the green neurons, meaning terminating in the forward moving layer. And then we got this displacement. The ellipse here represents our confidence interval, to answer your question about significance. Okay, and because that ellipse does not include the origin, we can say that it's significant, and this is, you know, 5%, whatever, 0.9, p equals 0.05. Okay, so up to that measure, it's significant.
I remember at the beginning you mentioned that you've done this for only a subset of columns. So are you suggesting that a different subset of columns would have such a shift in centroid that correspond to other cardinal directions?
So there are approximately 3.5 to 4 T4s per column.
Okay.
So you can have each of the four directions represented for each column.
Okay.
However, I have to be completely honest, that deep layer of the medulla, the crystalline periodic structure is not easily identified.
Okay.
Is there something special with the MI1 or TM3
Right. Let me answer this in a minute. Okay. So we did the same for the other T4s that terminate in the other three layers. And with the exception of the blue layer, there is a very nice agreement. Okay. In the interest of time, it should probably move on. And what I should say now is that we were able not just to fill in the missing gap by assembling the connectome, but to identify the specific neuron types, TM3 and MI1, that are likely involved in the motion detection and show that they receive inputs from the displaced parts of the visual field, which are displaced in the direction that correlates with the directional preference of the T4s that those TM3 and MI1s innervate. But the question remains, right? So I started with this two famous models, and we were able to show that in these models, the preferred direction goes from TM3 to MI1. That's what our connectomics told us. But which one of the models is correct? Okay, so what are the differences between the models? Well, one is the sign of the inputs. Unfortunately, can't do it, at least not now. Another is the nonlinearity, but I actually think that multiplication can be easily replaced by the rectification, even in this case. And multiplication in neurons is questionable anyway, so it doesn't tell you much. So the only thing that can distinguish these two models at this point in time is the time delay. So the question that was asked is exactly right. So can we tell whether the time delay is an MI1 or TM3? Because based on our connectomics identification that the preferred direction is from TM3 to MI1, this will differentiate between the two models. Unfortunately, no matter how hard we looked at the dimensions of those axons, they were both too small and too similar to give the required difference in time delays due to just electrotonic properties. At the moment, we think that the delays come from the synapses because it is known, for example, in the vertebrate retina, that you can introduce delays by using ionotropic versus metabotropic receptors up to 30, 40 milliseconds, which is plenty to build a motion detector. However, we still don't know which receptors are used by the TM3 and MI1 and T4. We're waiting for that information. But fortunately, we communicated our findings about the circuitry and the cell types before publication, and our friends at NYU were able to record from this cell types. And here is the result of their heroic experiments, where they plot the reverse correlation filters. Think of this as just impulse response of TM3s in green and MI1s in magenta. You can see two things. Just like in the spatial domain, there is quite a bit of spread. But just like in spatial domain, there is also a displacement between the centroids. And it turns out that MI1 responds with a greater delay than TM3. Pointing a finger towards Barlow-Levick implementation. Of course, this is very preliminary, and I would like to see the signs of those synapses first.
So it seems to be just a few milliseconds, the difference.
15 milliseconds.
15?
15.
So if I look at the spatial and the distance between adjacent fields and the 15 milliseconds, to which speed is this related, and how is that related to the kind of
right?
This is good at.
Right. This is an excellent question, and in fact, when I started this work, I thought that the displacement should be one intermatidial distance, and the delay would be pretty big. But it turns out that that's not the case. The displacement is actually a small fraction of the intermatidial distance.
Okay.
And the delay is also smaller than what we thought. Now, whether this 15 milliseconds is sufficient or not, you can build a model, and Damon Clark did, and it's sufficient. But there are several caveats you have to realize. Well, first of all, this is the delay at this stage of the circuitry. If you believe that the delays are in the synapses, there is still another layer when you get to T4.
That's not the question I'm asking, sorry. If I accept that this is the delay,
yeah,
and I ask what is the angular difference between two adjacent material, what is the corresponding angular velocity,
right,
and how does that relate in a behavioral environment to the angular velocity,
right. This does seem consistent, but I have to make a cautionary statement that actually when you analyze this kind of detectors, the invariant maximum in the response is not in the velocity variable, it's in the temporal frequency variable. And the maximum response is in 1 hertz. And it's not, it's a little bit tricky to convert that into the time delay. Okay?
It would be very tricky to convert 15 milliseconds into 1 hertz.
Right, but it's not, it's once you go through the calculations, it does all work out. Okay, but it's not. It's not that straightforward. So the question is absolutely valid, but the answer is a little bit involved. Okay? So with these caveats that there is an additional synapse that may introduce additional delays, and with the fact that we still don't know the signs, and the fact that there could still be a Hassenstein-Reichert kind of circuitry between different neurons of TM3 types, right? So we kind of assume that all neurons of the same cell type have the same delay because, you know, that's the meaning of the cell type, that they use the same neurotransmitters and so on. But there could still be different delays. So there is still possibility that Hassenstein-Reichert lives. And also there are suggestions of hybrid models combining the two. But at least based on the hard evidence we have so far, our favorite is the Barlow-Levick model. So that's pretty much what I was going to say about the fly motion detection. I should also say that we think that this is not relevant not just for flies, it's also relevant for vertebrates. And the piece of evidence I would like to show to support that is the morphology of these neurons involved. So it turns out that the dendrites of T4s that prefer different directions of motion actually are oriented in that direction of motion. And this is just like the cells in the vertebrate retina, like the ones called JMB cell, which responds to the vertical motion. Of course, it doesn't prove that the mechanism is the same, but it is.
In the retina.
Yeah. So there's motion. There's motion detection. Different layers of visual processing. But I think the one that is relevant to compare to fly would be in the vertebrate retina. And also the receptive fields that have been mapped out physiologically, they do show this overlapping on and off zones, which are very reminiscent of the ones that we determine anatomically. Okay? Of course, this is only suggestive, okay? This is different animal, different neuron, different technique, but same colors. Anyway, so we think that the mechanism that we studied may be relevant to vertebrates. And generally, going beyond motion detection, I think that these two motifs, one loosely corresponding to Hassenstein-Reichert and one, the other loosely corresponding to Barlow-Levick, may actually be the basic building blocks of neural computation. Because if you think from the signal processing perspective, there might be just two operations that you would ever want to perform on signals. If your signals are very noisy, you might want to increase signal-to-noise ratio by averaging over different inputs. And if you're looking for high-order correlations, pass them through a nonlinear. If, on the other hand, your signal-to-noise ratio is very high, and the two channels are redundant, you can actually subtract the redundant component to make a better use of the dynamic range of neurons, which is notoriously small, as in some sort of a predictive coding sense. And that's what this motif could be doing. And then you can put together these building blocks to build something more interesting, like, for example, this Olshausen and Field model, which is supposed to emulate the visual cortex, can be thought of being built out of this kind of building blocks. And finally, to conclude this talk, I hope I was able to convince you that connectomics, when combined with other approaches such as theory, behavioral or genetic analysis, and physiology, can in fact provide insights into neural computation that would otherwise be difficult, if not impossible, to obtain. And this is the acknowledgments. I should say that this work was done by the efforts, not just my group alone. It was a project of a big team effort at Genelia, the so-called FLY-M project, which I initiated and led for 5 years. And my main collaborators in this work were Ian Meinertzhagen, who has a lab in Canada, Lou Sheffer, another lab head in Genelia, Shinya Takemura, who was the research scientist on the project, and he did the lion's share of the connectome assembly. Arjun Bariok was my student who did the computational analysis of the motion detection circuitry. He now has his PhD and is looking for a job. And I also want to thank the rest of the members of my group, both past and present, who contributed to different stages of the project. Thank you very much.
So back on the theory side, when you introduced the two models, I didn't say anything, but I was quietly cheering for the first model, because the second model, at least naively, seems what some people would call, some of our friends would call, non-robust, in the sense that you immediately, once you introduce these two different classes, you immediately need to assume their relative strength, because of subtracting apples from oranges, and you have to make them the same. Whereas in the first case, you make them all more or less the same, different delays, you're just sensitive to different velocities, which is what you want to do anyway.
I think that the question is an excellent one, but I'm not sure I followed your logic for why the second was less robust than the first, because I think
we have two different neurons and we're subtracting one from the other.
Well, but here you have, in the first you have two different neurons and you're
multiplying,
adding and multiplying.
No, different types of neurons.
But you have to. No, you have to have different types in the first case because one has to have a delay and the other doesn't.
It's completely equivalent. It's just a delay will depend on the direction.
But you don't need to subtract exactly down to zero. You have a threshold in the rectifier so that you have some tolerance. You know, you don't need to, you don't need to precisely cancel out.
So what I think that, you know, the question, so I think that this question should be addressed theoretically. My suspicion is that one could get both of them in a sort of, you know, robust framework. But if you think otherwise, I would like to know the logic.
Well, I'll just say that for people who want to leave, please feel free to do so. You don't want to have more discussion with this technique. Because remember, we have a second talk today, started at 3:30, about 1 hour from now. So Chuck will talk about his model of this class.